Translation by Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has no material birth, activities, name, form, qualities, or faults. To fulfill the purpose for which this material world is created and destroyed, he comes in the form of a human being, like Lord Ram or Lord Krishna, by his original internal potency. He has immense potency, and in various forms, all free from material contamination, he acts wonderfully. He is therefore the Supreme Brahman. I offer my respects to him. Repetitively, please. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has no material birth, activities, name, form, qualities, or faults. To fulfill the purpose for which this material world is created and destroyed, he comes in the form of a human being like Lord Ram or Lord Krishna. By his original internal potency. He has immense potency, and in various forms, all free from material contamination, he acts wonderfully. He is therefore the Supreme Brahman. I offer my respects to him. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In the Vishnu Purana, it is said, Gunamscha doshamscha mune vyatita samasta kalyana gunatmako hi. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has no material form, qualities, or faults. He is spiritual and is the only reservoir of all spiritual qualities. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita 4.8 by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Paritranaya sarunam vinashaya cha duskritam. The Lord's activities of saving the devotees and annihilating the demons are transcendental. Anyone annihilated by the Supreme Personality of Godhead gets the same result as a devotee who is protected by the Lord. Both of them are transcendentally promoted. The only difference is that a devotee goes directly to the spiritual planets and becomes an associate of the Supreme Lord, whereas demons are promoted to Brahmaloka, the impersonal effulgence of the Lord. Both of them, however, are transcendentally promoted. The Lord's killing or annihilation or annihilating of the demons is not exactly like the killing of this material world. Although he appears to act within the modes of material nature, he is Nirguna, above the modes of nature. His name is not material. Otherwise, how could one get liberation by chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Rama? The names of the Lord, like Rama and Krishna, are none different from the person Rama and Krishna. Thus, by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, one constantly associates with Rama and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore becomes liberated. A practical example is Zajamil, who always remained transcendental to his activities simply by chanting the name Narayan. If this was true of Ajamil, what is to be said of the Supreme Lord? When the Lord comes to this material world, he does not become a product of matter. This is confirmed throughout Bhagavad Gita, Janma Karma Chime Divyam, Avajananti mam mudha manushim tanam ashritam. Therefore, when the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Rama or Krishna, descends to act transcendentally for our benefit, we should not consider him an ordinary human being. When the Lord comes, he does so on the basis of his spiritual potency, sambhavami atmamaya. Because he is not forced to come by the material energy, he is always transcendental. One should not consider the Supreme Lord an ordinary human being. Material names and forms are contaminated but spiritual name and spiritual form are transcendental. Om Gyanatmanandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshuranmalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. There, I was hearing a presentation recently. One lady, she specializes in regression. Regression is a process where you get hypnotized and you're taken back further and further back, and then you go back into a previous life. So some people have this ability to analyze people in previous lives. So she's giving one explanation. How there was a man, he was quite traumatized. And this is oftentimes where people want to seek regression. Why is it? What's happened to me? Why am I feeling so troubled in this life? What happened to me, perhaps, in a previous life? Anyway, she was a bit of a skeptic when she started doing this kind of experimentation, but gradually she became convinced of the authenticity of regression. So she gave one testimony how one man, he was quite perplexed in this life. So she went back in his previous life, and he had some affair or relationship with a girl or a young lady. I'm not sure how old she was. I think she may be quite young. And consequently, it created a big scandal in his family, so much so that because in those days, honor was very important, especially to the family. Nowadays, people don't care two hoots, but in those days, honor was very important. So his brother was so traumatized by what he had done that he had a duel with him. And in those days, they have a gun and they step out at each other and aim the gun at each other and try and shoot each other. So the brother who challenged him lost. So this boy, this man, who had this, you could say, unauthorized, illicit relationship, he was ostracized by his family. And so much so that he died. He actually died of hunger because he had no means to look after himself. And what's interesting is that in this life, he had suffered abuse in the same way that he had abused this girl in his previous life. So this is our birth. Our birth is that we are born to have the reaction of the actions that we have sown. So in this life, we suffer so many things because of something that we have done in our previous life, but we may not remember what it is. In some places, Srila Prabhupada says that the reaction for killing cows is that you'll be born and aborted. You kill your mother kills you. There's a reaction for it. So who would have known there's a connection there? So Krishna's birth is not like that. He hasn't taken his birth because of some karmic reaction in a previous life. He just comes at his own will. It's a dilemma for modern scientists because they rarely have a concept of things beyond matter. In fact, I remember I often listen to some of the lectures by Druta Karma, and he gives an example. He was giving I may have mentioned this last time, but he was talking to an audience in South Africa. These were all professors and students. And he was talking about how in the science of archaeology, the scientific community have this knowledge filtration system where only the knowledge that supports Darwin gets through to the textbooks and the modern education. And knowledge which kind of is different, they doesn't get through. So he gave this explanation, and he gave me examples how it was going on like that. So after the lecture, many scientists came to him, and they said, actually, it's not just archaeology. It's the same in chemistry, the same in biology. In other words, all aspects of life, knowledge is filtered out. And Druta Karma, he cites all these famous scientists that we would know by their name, but we don't hear in our school education that they were investigating metaphysics or the science of things beyond the material. And a lot of these scientists were experimenting with seances and experimenting with levitation and all different various kind of things. Druta Karma gives some examples how there was one sitting, one session, and all these guys were together. They're scientists, so they're not going to just be duped. They had a very controlled environment. And one famous mystic, or I'm not sure, they didn't use the word mystic, but in front of them, he got up, walked out the window, and floated across outside, and then came back in again. And all these scientists witnessed this. So there's a whole science about this metaphysics. Now, why it's important, and Judah Carmer, in his book, he wrote this book, Forbidden Archaeology. And then the next question, okay, if you're poo-pooing the Darwin idea, what's your explanation? So now he goes into all this scientific evidence to show that there is scientific evidence that supports a consciousness element. So this is sometimes how they use this element. I've even heard it recently in some presentation, these kind of modern critiques of modern society. They will talk about there's the consciousness. But even when they're talking about consciousness, they're not understanding the personality of Godhead. They're still having to anything but God. Now, Judah Carmen mentions, or I was reading recently, that one of the reasons why science gave up religion is because, almost they're almost addicted to not even giving religion any credibility at all, is because religion wasn't able to satisfy scientific inquiry. I mentioned before that I saw this challenge by Dawkins, and he was talking to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he said, "Do you believe that man has only been around for 6,000 years?" The Archbishop waffled, basically. He didn't have an answer, because that's what they believe, that man, like ourselves, has only been existing 6,000 years. But yet science shows, archaeology shows, that people like ourselves have been going back for thousands of years. Of course, Judah Carmer will show that people like ourselves have been going back for millions, billions of years. And that's what we would expect to see as Vedic scientific viewers. So if you can't answer scientifically, then why would a scientific accept it? So Srila Prabhupada would say that Krishna consciousness is a science. The science of birth, the science of death, there's a science of God. So there's various things that you can analyze to appreciate there's something else going on. It's interesting because this verse talks about potency. And things have got potency that we can't appreciate. I mean, one word here, let me just say one word that Krishna says, he is, where's that word now? Where is it? Swa Maya, by his own potency. So what is our potency? How much potency do we have? We have some potency. Each of us has our own individual abilities. Sometimes people are great studiers. Sometimes people are great physical exerters. Sometimes people are great artists. And different people got different potencies. Everyone has a unique contribution, you could say, and a unique expression. But where does our creative potency come from? We didn't create it. We're not consciously architects. For example, we may try and do something that is completely out of our ability. We may never be able to do it. We have certain limitations. We're born into our potency. Krishna says, "I am the ability in man." But he's not born into it. He is Atma Maya, or Swamaya, by his own potency. He, by his own self, and he's potent. And not just to a limited degree, Ananta Shaktaye. He has unlimited potency. For example, this morning I was doing the arti, and we do the whisk, which is a tail of a cow. Okay, the yak or whatever it is, but it's a cow, it's a type of cow. And when you wave this, why do you wave this whisk? What's it about? What's happening when you wave this chamara? Why are we doing it? Why is it auspicious? I'm a bit deaf in this ear because I got blocked up with... I should speak loudly. It's auspicious. Why is it auspicious? Anybody know why it's auspicious? Okay, it keeps the flies away, which is that's auspicious. Okay, it's got a practical function. There was one time where a fly was buzzing around Srila Prabhupada, and the guy was giving it his whole kind of, orchestral dance with the chamara, and he wasn't even noticing that the fly was buzzing around Srila Prabhupada. So, Prabhupada, what are you doing? You're meant to get the flies away. Yes, it has a practical function. Which element? Interesting, I don't know. Okay, anything else? Royal insignia. We often see, you often hear it when Krishna enters the palace or come out to Dwarka, they have the chamras, so it has some kind of royal insignia, great pomp and... Yeah, there's a story, one of the pastimes, where Putana witch, after Putana witch, his parents immediately got Krishna and they waved the whisk of a cow's tail. They doesn't say exactly what kind of, they didn't do 4, 2, 3 or 7, or they just basically waved it around Krishna's body. Well, it describes there that it gets rid of all obstacles. Now, who would have thought that? Who would have thought this little kind of tail of a cow would contain such potency that actually it can affect your karma? It can actually protect you from all dangers. Who would have thought that? So this little tail of a cow has got so much potency. Now, it's interesting, later on in the next chapter, before I gave class, I asked my wife, what verse are we on? So she sent me to the next chapter to find the verse. Anyway, interesting, I found an interesting verse there. I did study for this one, mind you, but that was a few days ago. I was on the wrong chapter and wrong verse. There's a verse there that talks about Krishna. He says, pastime of Gajendra and the alligator has got unbelievable potency. That you can become completely purified of your whole existence just by concentrating on this pastime and meditating on it and reciting it. And it lists a whole bunch of things. I won't go there because you'll come to it in due course. It lists a whole bunch of things, the elephant, the hills, the water, the bright list, and actually a cow is mentioned. There's like 20 different things. A cow is mentioned there. That if you concentrate and meditate on a cow with concentration, you get free from all your sins. You become liberated. This is potency. So we can't see potency, but it's there all the time. So Krishna, he's got unlimited potency. There's a verse that we chant regularly. This is drooping this mic here. Nam namakari bahuda nija sarva shaktis tatrapita niyame smarane nakala etadrishi tava kripa bhagavan mamapi durdaivam idrisham ihajani nanuraga. Some of the points that Srila Prabhupada makes in this verse and purport, you could say, are bread and butter of our Krishna consciousness philosophy. These are the essential things that you will tell people. And he goes into Krishna, his birth is not normal, it's not ordinary, and the potency of the holy name. So this verse, nam namakari bahuda nija sarva shaktis, nija sarva shaktis. All shakti contains all your transcendental potencies. Nam nam, which means many names. Akari bahuda, many different names. Bahuda, nija sarva shaktis. So Krishna's names contain all the transcendental potencies. So here, this verse, Srila Prabhupada mentions here, and the verse talks about that Krishna's got no form, arupaya, namarupe, any material name or any material form. But Prabhupada mentioned in the purport that Krishna and Krishna's name are the same. So all the potencies that Krishna has are there present when you come in contact with the name of Lord Krishna and Lord Rama. And Prabhupada mentions here that the process of purification is to always chant the names of Krishna, and therefore you become liberated. So who would imagine this? It's funny because Prabhupada says here, he kind of asks a question. It's kind of interesting. Where is it now? Krishna is nirguna, above the modes of nature. His name is not material. Otherwise, how could one get liberation by chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Rama? It's an interesting kind of argument when you think about it. In other words, Srila Prabhupada's stating something that is, you could say, a complete truth. From his perspective, obviously you'll get liberated by chanting Hare Krishna. It's not something argument you could use to the common man. They wouldn't know what you're talking about. Isn't there a story there that in Haridas Thakur? Haridas Thakur said that you can become liberated just by namabhas, not even pure chanting, but almost pure chanting. And someone doubted it. So Haridas Thakur made some comment about it. And he said, if it is true what you're saying or something, then you lose your nose or something. And this person, because he made an offense, then he lost his nose from leprosy. I don't know the exact, but it's more or less like that. So this is our dilemma, actually. Our dilemma is that we're hearing again and again and again, practically every verse and purport, how Krishna and Krishna's name are non-different. So we can, I suppose, reflect on that same verse I quoted, that Lord Caitanya was praying that, how is it then that I have no taste? This is my great misfortune, that I have no taste for chanting the names of Krishna or Rama. So our barometer is, how much do we believe this? And how much time and energy are we putting into manifesting our belief in this? Some of the points here. Oftentimes you may hear people talk about creation. Many organizations, those also with religious backgrounds, will talk about creation, but hardly anyone talks about dissolution or destruction. But here, the purport Prabhupada mentions, to fulfill the purpose which this material world is created and destroyed. People hardly want to hear about destruction. They want to hear about creation. And that's why sometimes there's an idea, there's almost a fear of death. So for some people, the idea of liberation is that this body that you have now and all the people you know, they'll go with you to some future place and live eternally. Someone told me one story one time that there was a priest or something, and he said, yes, when I go to heaven, I'll spend the first 1,000 years praying, and after that I'll play golf. Some statement like that. So, unfortunately, everything's going to end. Even this wonderful planet that we're so attached to has a finite end to it. People are hardly aware of what creation is. They don't know even what this universe is. They look at the night sky. They don't know how big it is. How big is this universe? 4 billion miles. How do you know that? Okay, 4 billion miles. It's actually described also in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I've got a verse here somewhere. Madhyalila, something or other. 21st chapter, 84. Prabhupada mentions there that the breadth of the diameter of the universe is 4 billion miles. Interesting. I don't know what the context of this is, but the diameter is 4 billion miles, and the day of Brahma is 4 billion years. Kind of interesting. Well, those kind of two connections are there. Just give you some context here. How they can never understand how big the universe is. How fast does a rocket go? Anyone know how fast a rocket goes? A rocket goes at, well, the different kind of, you've got to get different kind of speeds to go different places. And the highest speed they can go to kind of break out of the Earth's orbit is 25,700 miles per hour. So if you could maintain that speed and use that speed to get to the end of the universe, anyone want to guess how long it would take you to get there? To work out the get to the outer limit where you crash into the Earth that's enveloping the space in the middle. Anyone want to make a guess? I had the benefit of doing getting my calculator out and working it out. Sorry? Okay, you're close. 17,767 years to go from one end to the other. So it's impossible. Modern man could never, I mean, that's in their idea of history. Modern man like us have only been around 10,000 years. So you have to double the amount of time that they think we've existed to even get to one end to the other. So it's completely not even possible for them to ever, by their rockets or probably their Sputniks or the Apollo, whatever it is, to actually physically get to the outer regions of this universe. Now, somehow or other, if you could travel at the speed of light, anyone remember what that? Okay, speed of light is 700 million miles per hour. So if you go 700 million miles per hour, it would take you 238 days to go from one part of the universe to the other side. So it's not possible. They've got no concept whatsoever. So when they're looking out into the sky and they're saying, yeah, that little dot there, that's a gaseous form, and they start making all these wonderful guesses about what's happening on some little twinkling star somewhere out there they have no concept of, and they're telling you what's happening on there. But they don't even know that every single planet is inhabited. They don't know because they're looking with their telescope and trying to work out what's going on. And so when Prabhupada talked about the frog in the well example, it's very literal. There's a frog in the well. Quack, quack. How big is a well? You know, two meters at the most. Some Indian wells are maybe 3 meters. What's that place you go to in Govardhan? And you look down and there's these frogs in the bottom of the well. And these frogs are trying to tell you how big the ocean is. How are they going to know? They've only got a little well, and that's all their existence is. How are they possibly going to estimate how big the ocean is by using their well as a reference point? So similarly, the scientists are trying to estimate the extent of this one little mustard seed universe. And it's so extensive they can't even comprehend it. Yet this, Krishna says almost like nonchalantly, this is your Lord Brahma, I'm sorry, you've got four heads, but you're only a small universal creator. There are universes where Brahmas have got 100 heads, 1,000 heads, 1,000,000 heads. So you can't possibly comprehend the extent of this one little universe. So it's interesting because we hear about the spiritual planets. So we can't even comprehend of these material planets. How can we possibly comprehend of spiritual planets? How far do you go? How do you get there? This pastime, it's in this verse that Krishna quotes, Parajanayastharanam Vinishash Duskitam, that his purpose in coming is to save the devotees. Pari tranai. Pari means all around. Parikram. You go around something. Pari tranai means you save the devotees from all sides. This is why he comes. He comes to save the devotees. And he comes to annihilate the demons. So where are we in all this? Have we got a chance here? Are we demons, in which case we might get killed, or are we devotees, in which case we might get saved? And actually, I was thinking that this Bhagavatam is Krishna. He's enabling us to become liberated. Like in this one verse, if you just have this one verse the rest of your life, you become liberated if you follow his directions. You've got everything you need to go back to Krishna at the end of this life by fully reading this one verse, absorbing yourself in it, and following its directions. So Krishna saved us. It described how when Krishna left, he left the Bhagavatam for us. He stayed behind as the Bhagavatam for us to study and save ourselves. It's interesting because how could you recite such an amazing prayer with a crocodile grabbed hold of your leg? What crocodiles do, you see some on these nature programs, the crocodile will kind of just sneak up like a log. Or maybe not even like a log, somehow they can see underwater, even muddy water, they can somehow there's ability. That's another potency. A crocodile can see even when the water is muddy. The closer we got to, we used to have these pigs, Vietnamese pot-bellied pigs. And sometimes you'd put in a bucket of sabji and all kinds of mixed foods that the devotees left behind. And you'd see these pigs rooting through this trough of mixed food, looking for various things with their noses. They had the potency to smell various things in a mixture of multifarious smells. And they'd be selecting various things, shoving things aside just to find, I don't know, a puri or something, what they liked. So they had a potency to identify certain foods in a swill. It's like sticking your nose into a bucket of khichdi and just selecting the dal, for example, as an example. So pigs have this amazing potency. And that's why Lord Krishna chose that form to rescue the earth, which had fallen into the bottom of the ocean. So the crocodile has the ability to actually see things on the side. Now the crocodile was a great king. He was called Huhu. You're going to hear about it later. And what had happened was that he was a Gandharva. Another controversial topic. Gandharvas? What are those? That's a mythological person. But this is a higher planet. And these Gandharvas, I couldn't really find descriptions of the Gandharvas. I read some descriptions, but I couldn't necessarily know if they were authentic. Some of the readings were about the Gandharvas were half man, half animal. For example, the, what's that mythological figure that's half man, half horse? Not unicorn. Sorry, I'm a bit blocked here. Not unicorn, no. Anyway, there's some mythological figure, half... Minotaur. Okay, I can't remember what it is. But anyway, I couldn't find a description of the Bhagavatam or Prabhupada's folio that describes what the Gandharvas are. Some people say they're just male, but they're musicians. So anyway, King Huhu was sporting in the river with ladies. Some girlfriends or wives or whatever. Yes, I can't remember what it says. You'll come again later. And he basically pulled on the leg of a sadhu. A sage was there swimming. And it's thing that we would do. Well, we kind of would do something like that, wouldn't you? You're playing in the water, and then suddenly your friend's having a bath, and you pull his leg, especially when the water can't, when you can't be seen. You pull his leg. Kind of playish thing. So he was cursed by the sage that you become a crocodile. So the difference between, you could say, that scenario and ourselves is that if someone pulled our leg and we're not feeling very, we might want to curse them in some kind of nasty way. We might say, hope a crocodile bites your leg or something. We actually might mean it, that hope a crocodile bites your leg. We might just think it like that. But in this case, the curse of the sage enabled this Gandharva, who it's described there, would have spent long, long, long time. What he said, that it's very hard to, he wants it because the enjoyment is so hard. It's so hard, the enjoyment is so wonderful that it's hard to surrender to Krishna. So it's been a long time in that place. So by being cursed by this sage, then the king became a crocodile. Now, I don't know whether he died on the spot when he got the curse or whether he had to die as a king and then become a crocodile. I'm not sure what happened there. But anyway, he became a crocodile, and then by having his head cut off, or his not his head, but his mouth was cut off. So maybe he wasn't headless, maybe he was just mouthless. Cut the head off the crocodile. Then it described there, it doesn't describe it in the same way as it does with Gajendra. With Gajendra, it's quite clear. He attained Svarupya, the same form as the Supreme Lord. Because he was the Lord. When the Lord came, the Lord actually grabbed him and pulled him out by his hand. So he pulled the elephant out of the water with the crocodile still attached to his leg. And then he cut the mouth off of the crocodile. So, but here describing how those who are killed by the Lord, they attain the same place. So did King Huhu, what was his destiny? Interesting, maybe for a future, one of you give a class in the future, you can clarify this point. Where did he go? With Gajendra, it's quite clear. He actually attained the same transcendental form as the Lord. Gajendra was clearly a devotee in his previous life. It described there how he was a king, and King Indradumna from South India, and he basically renounced kingly life and was meditating in the forest. In ecstasy, it's described, he was very advanced spiritually. Another sage came by, and because wasn't greeted, he said, "You're just like a dumb elephant, therefore become an elephant." So in one sense, it was a curse, but in another sense, it was a blessing, because it enabled him in one life to go back to Godhead. So there's a lot more things that could be said here. So I'll stop there if anybody has any questions or points.